Assignment tonight for you guys was that you'd go do some research on the kinds of things we've been talking about. So I'm curious what you guys have to say about your research. I did some research as well, and so I think it'd be fun to kind of compare what we found. But let's just remind ourselves of what we're doing in these classes. So these first seven classes, I guess, we've been talking about the different universal needs that people have. And other, all listed there. And what have we been doing with each of these human needs?
We're talking about the world approach versus the biblical approach.
Right. So we're contrasting, if you don't have God in your life, how would you try to find meaning in life? And we're trying to quote, we're quoting from atheists and skeptics. We're trying to really represent what a secular person would do. To find meaning, and then we're deconstructing that and comparing it to the biblical worldview with each one of these things. Whenever I've done my studies with atheists and skeptics, the first times that I did it, I thought it would be better to start with, here's why God exists, here's why the Bible's reliable, here's why Jesus really rose from the dead, all that kind of thing. But we live in a society today that is not objectively minded. It's more about like how I feel. So if you can show people that God meets your subjective needs, it maybe gets the foot in the door to actually talk about the objective arguments for the existence of God, things like that. So this is our last class where we're talking about different human needs, and we could even add more to that. In fact, I'd really be curious what other needs you guys might add to this list that we have here so that I can even further expand this, and maybe we could all do that together at some point. But starting next week, then, should be lessons 8 through 13, we're going to be doing more objective evidences for Christianity. And whenever I've studied with skeptics, after we shift from talking about these universal needs, a lot of the emotional barriers to why people didn't like Christianity have, like, not totally evaporated, but been mitigated to a large extent. And then they're more open to, here's why God actually exists and stuff like that. Because they're not constantly, like, worried about these other things and how they find more meaning in something else outside of God or whatever. They've seen that God has better answers for all these things. So does that make sense as far as the direction of where we're going and all this? All right, so let's just remind ourselves the purpose, why we're doing these classes. Number one, I'm hoping that we'll see all the more how Christianity makes better sense of the world. The word truth, what does the word truth mean? Truth is whatever accords with reality. So a banana is yellow, and that accords with reality, because you look at it and it's yellow. So truth is whatever accords with reality. And so Christianity makes the best sense of the world. It is truth. It does fit the things that we need, and it has the best answers for the things that we struggle with. So trying to see that as we go through this, trying to strengthen our own faith as we see these things, and then also provide tools for conversations for people that we might interact with. We've talked about this in a lot of the classes, but what are some of the causes of skepticism in our society today?
Not all powerful, that'd be good.
Yeah, there's some kind of like, sometimes it's like this bad taste that you've got with something that you've seen in the Bible or something that you can't match with the way the world is, desire to sin, what else?
Past religious experiences.
Yeah, bad past religious experiences, things like that. So here's the ones that I got up here. What is oftentimes couched in academic, really smart conversations about why somebody doesn't believe in the Bible, like, you know, there's all these contradictions in the manuscripts of the Bible and all these things. It sounds like really academic, like heavy stuff. What's oftentimes behind it is somebody wants to do some certain sin that they don't like the Bible saying that they can't do. They've had some bad religious experience, they've been burned in some way, or there's some kind of like thing that the Bible teaches that doesn't jive with them. Or it's just become more common in our society. I'm not saying that this is these are always the reasons somebody might be a skeptic, but I think sometimes somebody has the veneer of objectivism when they're like quoting from a bunch of really smart atheists and stuff like this. And we think that the real debate is, well, God exists because of these arguments. Maybe more often than not, this is where the real argument is, and these are where the real discussions need to be had. So, yeah, Jim?
I was just going to say, but you know, the desire to sin is true whether it's a skeptic or it's a God-fearing individual.
Right, and if for a God-fearing person, they might start changing some of their positions on doctrines.
They really do, because right. I had this very conversation with a guy my age the other day that, I mean, it's just, I mean, he, you know, once I said, well, I hadn't seen him in a while. I was just having a conversation with him, and I said, well, how's everything in your relationship with God? And, you know, it just started tanking from there.
Yeah.
Because he was making excuses for the way he was changing his doctrinal beliefs because he wanted to basically allow himself to sin.
And we might think that in a situation like that, the real debate is the doctrinal issue that he's fighting for or has these like sophisticated arguments for, when really it's like, let's peel it back and ask what's behind all of this. That's where the conversation... I remember one time, the first time I ever realized this, I was in Minnesota on vacation, and I was meeting with a guy that I had known from the church before I moved to Nashville, and he wanted to get together and get coffee, so we got coffee, and he was like, you know, I'm starting to think that the Bible's not reliable and it's not trustworthy and all this kind of stuff. And I said, what I said to him was, we can have the conversation about the reliability of the Bible, but before we even start down that path, like, please be honest with this question. Is there anything that the Bible teaches that you don't like that's really frustrating you? And he said, yeah, and then he opened up about some things, and that's where the conversation was. What if I just said, okay, well, let's start talking about the reasons why the Bible's actually trustworthy. His will or his desire was not in that. And that would not have convinced him in any way, because there was something behind what seemed like a sophisticated argument. Does that make sense? And so, like, I don't know if you guys know people that have become skeptics, or you've got some skepticism within you that you've been, like, scared to share with anybody. Ask yourself and be honest if it's something like this that's driving it. It might not be, but I think 80% of the time it is, if I had to just throw a number out there. So, with that being said, we're talking about universal human needs. A lot of these things are emotional reasons somebody wouldn't believe in God or the Bible. And so what we're trying to do is show the emotional reasons somebody should believe in God and the Bible. And today we're doing this with the need for forgiveness. And whether you're a Christian or a secular person or whatever, any religion, everybody's got this problem of guilt. And we're going to get to that, but let me start out with this question. How would you define what forgiveness is?
Second chance.
Okay, good. Second chance, like clean slate. What else?
Forgetting.
Yeah, it involves, in Jeremiah 31, when he talks about the new covenant that God's going to make with the house of Israel and Judah, notice the northern and the southern, there's going to be some kind of reunification of north and south, which, by the way, happens in Acts chapter 8. Anyways, that's when the gospel goes to Samaria, and it's come from Jerusalem, and so God is like, it's a cool Bible theme. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, forgiveness. So in Jeremiah 31, he talks about, I will remember their sins no more. So it involves something about forgetting. What else would it involve?
Cleansing.
Yeah, cleansing, like, you're pure now before God.
Moving forward.
Yeah, moving forward. Like, it's done. Like, it's not going to be brought up again. Like, I think the best definition of forgiveness I've ever read is forgiveness is a promise to not hold a sin against somebody anymore. That's what it means to forgive somebody. You're promising that I will not use this against you anymore. And so this is something that I think everybody has a need for. We all want to have this sense of being forgiven because we've all done things that haunt us if we spent any time thinking about it. So I asked you guys to do some research then on what's the evidence that whether you're a Christian or an atheist, that everybody's got this sense of guilt, which would lead into this need for forgiveness. Yeah, Ben?
When I was looking at some stuff, I came across, and I sent it to you, but I came across this this Reddit post, which I thought was kind of funny, but this atheist put out this question on Reddit that was like, how do atheists handle extreme guilt without a God to forgive them? And so that has several layers, obviously, but he's feeling guilty and doesn't have an outlet for forgiveness because he doesn't have a God that he's serving. So he goes on to like explain that he's done something terribly wrong. And he says it's worse than even murdering someone, which I don't know what he did, but he's genuinely asking this question on a forum online, you know, what did I do?
Did you read some of the responses?
I did read some of the responses. It had solutions.
What were some of the solutions? Well, actually, we might get to that in a
moment.
Yeah, but so here's an atheist saying there's something that haunts him.
Yes.
So guilt is not uniquely for the religious.
No.
At least, now, you can deaden your conscience so much and become a sociopath. That's something that happens. But generally speaking, everybody's been built with a conscience that feels guilt.
And so he's, for years, been dealing with this, like, guilt from this thing that he did and wants to know how to get better.
And he even acknowledges in the post that he made that, like, if I had a God that would forgive it, that would make some of it easier, basically.
Yeah,
he's implying that.
He says, one of the only religious notions that I respect is the idea of forgiveness. I know what it feels like to truly repent, and it's the absolute worst feeling in the world. I'm an atheist. I don't believe there is a God out there to forgive me. I am accountable for my actions.
Okay, good. So there's an example of an atheist that feels this guilt. Did you guys find any other evidences of the universal feeling of guilt people have? I said we weren't going to spend much time on this question because I think it's pretty obvious. I did find this quote. I don't remember where I found this. Psychology Today. I figured this was going to be a good one for this class. So she says, guilt is first and foremost an emotion. Now, I'm going to take exception with that, but keep reading. You may think of guilt as a good way to get someone to do something for you out of a sense of obligation, but that's more accurate. But it's more accurate to think of guilt as an internal state. In the overall scheme of emotions, guilt is in the general category of negative feeling states. Just when she explains this emotion that is something that is in the overall scheme of emotions, a category of negative feelings, you think everybody feels something like that, whether you're religious or not. Now, is guilt an emotion only? Does it involve emotion? I'll say that first. It can involve emotions. Does it always involve emotion, though?
Her own quote says it's an internal state.
Yes.
She knows that there's something continuous about this.
Yes, yes. And so guilt would also have an objective component. Like, if I murdered somebody and I didn't feel bad about it, under her definition, I don't have guilt, right? If I'm strictly going with her definition, that it's an emotion. Yeah, Nick?
I've looked up something on the psychology of forgiveness, and this quote came up. Forgiveness, in a psychological sense, is the intentional and voluntary process by which one who may initially feel victimized undergoes a change in feelings and attitudes regarding a given offense and overcomes negative emotions such as resentment and vengeance.
Okay. Was that from Psychology Today?
It might be.
Okay. Yeah. So, like, could somebody still have guilt? In what sense would somebody have guilt if they didn't feel the emotion of guilt? Like, who has to let them know that they're guilty in that situation? Like a police officer, right? So if I break some law and I don't feel bad about it, there's an objective sense. And when I mean objective, I mean like outside of my subjective experience, there's a reality to my guilt. That's true regardless of how I feel about it. And so I think when you add both of these together, that involves an emotion. Some people might not feel the emotion, but there's still this objective sense in which some people have done things. People have never even like lived up to their own set of standards. Like, here's one illustration to prove this. Let's say for a moment that somebody says that there's no objective moral right or wrong, and we can kind of choose what we're going to do for ourselves. And you were able to record every time that person was frustrated with how people treated them. So, like, I'm the person that says there's no objective moral right or wrong. And then somebody was able to crawl in my head and for, like, 10 years, like, record all the ways that I was frustrated with people. Like, the time somebody cut me off in the road. And that time that somebody used a mean tone to me. And that time that somebody lied to me. And then somebody held up my own standards against me. Would I live up to them? No. I wouldn't even live up to my own sense of what's right and wrong. So guilt is a universal part of, I think, being in this world that we live in that's broken. So this gets us into the second point. What are the secular solutions to the problem of guilt? And I, on my sheet, I have it broken up into like untaught, more like natural vice solutions that are not real solutions, but things that kind of come instinctively that are sinful. And then I also have things that people try to like meditate on and think about in certain ways that would not be still the biblical approach. But before I show you what I found, what did you guys find as being some of the secular solutions to the problem of guilt? If you don't have God, how do you get forgiveness?
Lowering your standards.
Was that one of the ones that you found? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like rather than... like having these high standards, or maybe one way to say it would be like getting rid of Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. If you get rid of Christianity, then you won't feel guilt. I'm going to have a quote about that in a little bit. Good. So that would be one approach. Matt, did you have something?
I mean, this one was harder to find for something. I found something on the idea of an atheistic Christian. The idea of living as if there is a God without believing in one. So it's uphold the religious aspects and morals, but have absolutely zero faith and belief in a higher power.
That's sort of like Jordan Peterson, maybe like a year ago. Like, he's closer and closer to believing that there is a God now, mm-hmm. but that's like sort of Jordan Peterson's perspective.
It's like, it goes along with the thing that we all kind of commonly hear over and over again. The only thing I respect from religion is forgiveness.
Yes.
So it's upholding the standards and the morals of a Christian without anything else.
And of course, one of the problems with that is if you get rid of the God who also forgives, like, you're left with a bunch of standards that you're not going to live up to. How many of you have read the Sermon on the Mount and thought, that was really inspiring? That Sermon on the Mount, like, should make all of us feel super duper guilty. If anybody's ever said, like, oh, I read the Sermon on the Mount and I feel like a good person, you did not read the Sermon on the Mount. Or you're, like, extremely arrogant. And I'll just assume that you didn't read it. Any other solutions to the problem of guilt that you guys found in your research, Nick?
I mean, I think you hear it a lot in, you know, general culture today, but it's a lot of loving yourself. And
yeah,
people are constantly talking about how, you know, you got to love your body image, you got to love
self-care,
you know, who you've become, and, you know, all the mistakes you've made are part of, like, you know, caring for yourself, and it's just part of your journey.
Yes. And let me say, the Bible never, ever, ever says to love yourself. Some people will say, well, Jesus said you have to love your neighbor as yourself. So that there's actually three instructions there. You love your neighbor, you love God, and then you love neighbor as yourself. The Bible assumes people love themselves and actually says you need to do that a little bit less. But it's saying, like, the way you take care of yourself and everything, and you're concerned about yourself, like, you know that by experience, and you put that same fervor towards loving other people. But the Bible never commands us to love ourselves. We already do. Even the person who cuts themselves. There's a girl that I knew in college who was gothic, and she cut herself on her thighs. And she was doing that out of a distorted version of self-love. So even people that inflict self-harm are still doing it out of a way of trying to preserve something within them. Yeah, Ian?
I think also, and we've seen, I mean, you see this all... You hear about this, and you've seen it, and you see it in fiction all the time. It's self-destruction, in a sense. It's not a no one believes that this particular solution is an actual solution, but it's something people will come to as just a self-destructive lifestyle. Like, you know, I do not like this feeling of guilt, so let me replace it with something else, whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's excessive eating.
Trying to dull,
sort of replace the guilt, but and I think secular and Christianity can both agree, you're not going to replace the guilt, so to speak, with something that still harms you.
Yeah. Well, and going back to the harm issue, asceticism, do you guys know what asceticism is? Did you guys ever see the Da Vinci Code movie? Remember Silas, the weird albino guy that was going to go kill people? Remember that thing he had on his thigh? It had the spikes on the thigh that he would tighten up. Do you know why he did that?
To be pious.
And he would whip himself in the back.
Isn't it supposed to be you get closer to God?
Yeah, and it's a way of if I inflict pain on myself, that's a way of purging myself from sin. Now, I don't think anybody in here goes and hits our head against the wall to try to make ourselves feel better through the pain of purging ourselves. I will tell you that one of my biggest struggles since being a Christian has been psychological asceticism. And what I mean by that is constantly going, I'm a failure, I'm a loser, I'm a good for nothing, and if I keep hitting myself with enough blows, maybe I'll feel good about myself because I'm purging it. Well, I can't forgive myself by saying all these kinds of things about myself. The only thing that can forgive me is God. But I think sometimes that's why we beat ourselves up so much, is we're trying to purge ourselves. And it doesn't, so that doesn't work either. But when Colossians 2 talks about asceticism, it says that this has no value in stopping the indulgences of the flesh. So I could have handled a situation really bad, or lied to somebody, or done something wicked towards somebody, and then afterwards gone, idiot, loser, I handled everything wrong. Is that going to really help me do it better the next time? No, but I'm trying to purge myself. And I think that's maybe one of the subtle ways that even Christians do this sometimes, is with this extremely negative self-talk to try to purge ourselves. Does that make sense? Okay, so, all right. Let me show you some of the things that I got, and you guys throw in whatever other things you found as well. So I broke it up into, there's untaught solutions, things that just kind of come naturally. In Genesis 3 and 4, have different ways that people are handling the weight of guilt now that it's entered the world. One of them is to hide in Genesis 3, verses 8 through 10. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden of the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, where are you? And he said, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. So sometimes when we have this feeling of guilt, one of the ways we try to handle it is by hiding. Well, who would we hide from?
Those who might see.
Yeah. So let's say that somebody just all of a sudden stops assembling with other Christians or hanging out with other Christians. Not all the time, but a lot of the times could that be because they're entrapped in some sin and they feel ashamed about it and they're trying to hide. So that would be one way that somebody tries to handle the weight of guilt, that I don't want to feel even more guilt by being around the people that remind me of the sin that I'm committing. So that would be an untaught, you didn't have to discipline yourself to do that. You just kind of instinctively did it. Another one is to shift the blame in Genesis 3, verses 11 through 13. He said, who told you that you were naked, or naked in the south? Have you eaten of the tree which I commanded you not to eat? The man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate. Then the Lord said to the woman, what is this that you have done? The woman said, the serpent deceived me, and I ate. All right, so God's pointing the finger at Adam, asking what he did, and what does he say?
It was Eve.
It was the woman.
The one that you gave me.
Yeah, the one that you gave me, God. So that's kind of ultimately your fault, because if you wouldn't have given me her, then that wouldn't have been a temptation for me. And then Eve is blaming the serpent, and so everybody's blaming other people. Have you ever felt that before, where you knew you did something wrong, and you desperately wanted somebody else to bear some of the load of it? And so, in those heated conversations and debates, you say, well, if you wouldn't have done this, then I wouldn't have even been in that situation, or, whatever. And maybe those things are true. Maybe those things are helpful to figure out how to have a better approach moving forward, but they don't abdicate your responsibility for what you did, right? So that's another thing, again, where we start to... This is, by the way, what very manipulative people do. Manipulative people always try to... If they're trying to have like a conversation about something that you didn't do that was not that they, you did that was not good, they'll immediately try to like throw shade on you to get the attention off of what needs to be discussed in the moment. So some people will shift blame. Another one is to hurt others. This happens in Genesis 4 with Cain killing Abel, but this is what 1 John 3:12 says about it. We should not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil and his brother is righteous. So he sees his brother being accepted by God. He's feeling guilty about those things, and then he just hurts somebody else in his guilt. None of those are things that require self-discipline. That's just acting like a predatory mammal. Any comments or questions on those ways that people try to handle their guilt? Yeah, important.
Working with kids all day, every day, past like 8 months or something like that, I can see that all those are definitely natural vices because it happens literally every day.
Right, and they, nobody had to teach him how to do any of that. Yeah.
I mean, literally every single one of those every day.
Right, this is a cool study, by the way, to look at the first couple chapters in Genesis after sin entered the world and just ask, guilt and sin is a new thing in the world. What were the very first responses to it? There's more things you could add to the list. I preached a sermon about that in California, and there's some other ones that you can add to it, but it's an interesting study.
But, you know, according to what, I mean, based on what the court's talking about, I mean, whether or not we work on self-improvement through God's word, determines whether or not we bring those things into adulthood.
Right. Yep.
And pride and arrogance, yep, and all of the terrible character traits that we should not have. If those things happen, those things happen.
Right. And so some people might be like, okay, well, you know, I don't like that. Even a secular atheist might go, well, it's not good to hide. It's not good to shift blame. And whenever I try to do this, I'm inflicting pain on other people. So how about I find some disciplines that are going to help me with my guilt? And here's a couple of solutions people have said. We've already alluded to some of these. Phil Zuckerman wrote this article about, I forget where the guy was from, but he was writing a story about somebody who got rid of his Christian faith. And it says this: this transition from Christianity to atheism was extremely liberating for Esteban. He felt a great burden lifted off his shoulders, raw relief. No longer was he tormented by the persistent existential fear that an angry God was going to send him to hell. So this is like, I feel free, there's not this God that's waiting for me to make a mistake. And so if I just get rid of this Christian perspective that I have, if I lower the standards, like Brittany said, then I'm not going to have as much guilt anymore. Have you guys heard people talk this way at all? It might be some particular sin that you're really addicted to that, like, you know, if I get rid of God, then my worldview wouldn't convict me anymore. And it's not because everybody wants to go out and murder people. It's because there's something that they're doing that, like, in the eyes of the world is not hurting other people or something like that. Would oftentimes be, I'm thinking of something like pornography. I've known people that walked away from God because they didn't want to feel guilty every time they watched porn. So that would be one example of that. Can you guys think, any comments or questions on this one? Yeah, Nick?
I think generally speaking, it's pretty hard to get away from the guilt regardless.
Yes.
I mean, generally, you know, the world has pretty good views on, you know, most things that are absolutely atrocious. I mean, we've seen some pretty bad, you know, changes in that in the last few years. But I think mentally, you know, psychologically, you will constantly have this guilt that, you know, what I'm doing isn't exactly right and it's not natural.
Right.
Like, I think of pedophilia as one, because it's become much more accepted in
right.
today's day and age recently, but I don't know how you do that or think like that and just don't have any of those feelings, whether somebody's telling you it's okay or not.
Right. So why do we need to have gay pride parades or something? Why do we need everybody to affirm it? Because within you, there's something that knows that there's not something right about this. And that's why you need so many people to affirm it. But even if you had the praise of the whole world, there's still something about doing these things that doesn't match the created order that God made us for. And I had a friend that, did I tell you guys about my friend that detransitioned from being a woman back to a man and how he shut out? And I talked to somebody yesterday at Panera who's got a cousin that the cousin is a guy transitioning to a woman. And they were trying to figure out, like, how to handle this. And so the conversation I had with my friend in high school, like, really helped me know some things to say, at least for the people yesterday. But, like, in every situation. Same thing with these people I talked to yesterday. They said the person will not talk to us anymore. They've closed out any voice that disagrees with us. So you're lowering your standards. You're getting rid of Christianity. You're getting rid of any voice that disagrees, but you still feel terrible about it. This is not minority stress. What the problem is that your worldview is not creating a sense of forgiveness. So that's one answer. Another one is, when I say here taught solutions, that these are misguided, or there's something true about some of these things. There's a small bit of truth. Some people, skeptics, atheists, they'll say, well, this is not an opportunity for self-improvement. So Kate Skourit from said this. Guilt is your mind's way of keeping you in check and making you considerate towards people around you. It is not a bad emotion. Without it, you would be sadistic and narcissistic. I think that's pretty good. Like, there's something about that that makes a lot of sense. At the same time, if guilt is keeping me in check, what about the times that I did not let my guilt keep me in check and I really made a grave mistake? The only thing it can do is currently kind of curb me, but it doesn't answer, that perspective doesn't answer, how do I still have like absolution from the things I've done? Here's another one.
Can I pause for a second?
Yes.
Because I read some about that, that goes along with that, I guess. I kept seeing this term, pro-social behavior.
Pro-social,
so when someone feels guilt, they want to make reparations by doing something pro-social, you know, some sort of behavior.
Interesting.
But in order to make that reparation, that behavior needs to be suggested. And then there's this fine line of, I'm going to suggest that you can do this. You know, if John does something to me that makes me upset, then I can say, well, here are some things that you could do to make it better, and I'll forgive you. But then if I'm too, I guess, blatant about it, too demanding about it, then he no longer feels that guilt.
Right.
So
it's like manipulative. It's like passive aggressive.
Sort of. If I'm not mistaken, this was about using it in a lot of advertising, like using guilt as an advertising ploy.
Interesting.
But then I kind of went down the rabbit hole with some of the resources that they used in that.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's actually what it was talking about.
That's interesting, though.
But anyway, so it didn't make sense, you know, it made sense what they were saying, but a level of guilt may depend on who you wronged and how they respond to you, how they react to you.
Okay.
So it may vary. I could do something to you and could do the same thing to somebody else, and y'all's reactions to me and how you want me to make reparations for it could determine my level of guilt.
I see.
So that's what I thought.
Which is highly subjective. There's no objectivity to that. Like, and how do you know what everybody is really thinking and if they're really going to be satisfied? You know, that's a hard thing to figure out. Matt, were you going to say something?
Yeah. Going off a little bit about that, and it's going to be in the next point as well, like the idea of forgiving yourself. Spoiler alert. There's a Will Smith movie called 7 Pounds, in which the whole plot is, you know, he does something terrible. He's trying to find a way to forgive himself for that. He goes to church, and there's a lack of belief in God, so there's no forgiveness there. And so he does the 7 Pounds, is the 7 ways of paying it back. And I don't want to spoil the movie because it's actually a really good movie. But
is the 7th pound meeting Jesus? The only one that worked.
You will like tear up. It's a tearjerker.
Really,
yeah, it's a good movie. But it's the idea of trying to find self forgiveness through the actions for others.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's, how do I forgive myself by getting the approval of my actions from others? That way.
Right. In other words, how do I make up for this?
Yeah.
Jim?
There's an Instagram account called, and I saw it through this other girl that's on Instagram, and it's not specifically about guilt, but it is about self-improvement or just self-absorbed. And this one girl reposted this from Commanding Life, is what the account is called. Remember to keep your standards high for what you can achieve. Keep your focus on the good things constantly unfolding for you. Keep your confidence centered on where you are going. Keep your faith fixated on the possibilities of your future. Keep your gratitude rooted in what you have already achieved. Keep your intentions clear about what you can create. I mean, all just so self-centered.
Yeah.
about absolutely everything that's anything in your life.
Right. And if you're the one needing forgiveness, focusing on yourself more is not going to help. You need something outside of yourself to help with this.
Right. And so, I mean, it's clearly, it's a, but they're saying that the whole thing is commanding life.
Yeah.
No, it's empty.
Yeah.
Really, when it comes to forgiveness.
Right. Yeah, that's good. I'm going to skip this one. Some people will talk about forgiving out of self-interest, and that's more about me forgiving somebody else and not about me being forgiven. But some people will say that, like, if you forgive other people, it'll make you feel better. And I talked about some of that in my sermon Sunday night, so I'm sure you guys were, like, just riveted with that sermon and remember all those details. So, I'll just skip that. I want to spend some time on this one. Forgive yourself. I have heard way too many Christians say this statement, that I need to learn to forgive myself. It is one of the most unbiblical things that you can say. I don't ever want to hear another Christian say it, but I'm sure I will. I understand what somebody means when they say it, that there's things that still haunt them. And so I'm not saying that, like, what's behind the statement that they're making is a real struggle. I'm not diminishing that. But the Bible says zero about forgiving yourself. You cannot forgive yourself. Only God can forgive. But here's somebody that talks about this. Hannah Rose says, self-forgiveness begins and ends internally. The reality is that we may never be fully forgiven by others, but that absolutely does not mean that we cannot find inner peace by forgiving ourselves. Additionally, even if everyone else that we have wronged forgives us, we will not feel peace and contentment until we truly forgive ourselves. All right, have you guys heard people talk in those kinds of ways? Even what she's saying sort of feels like it makes sense, right? Like, you can really harm other people, and then they'll say, look, it's done, I forgive you. And you're like, yeah, but I still feel like an idiot for having done that, and you can't, like, drop it. So that's why I say, when somebody says a statement like this, they mean something that is, like, a real struggle. So can anybody explain, though, like, what's wrong with this notion of forgiving yourself? Other than some of the things I've already said.
I think there's a little bit of a hubris in it, in that, you know, you think you have that capability of forgiving sin.
Right. There's hubris that you have the capacity to do it, but one of the things that's interesting is I've talked to so many people that say, I know God's forgiven me, but I just can't forgive myself. So God, who is mightier than you, was able to do something that, like, you could never do by his strength or something. Like, there's something that's not amiss here. Timothy Keller, in his book Counterfeit Gods, says this about this idea. When people say, I know God forgives me, but I can't forgive myself, they mean that they have failed an idol, whose approval is more important to them than God's. Idols function like gods in our lives, and so if we make career or parental approval our God and we fail it, then the idol curses us in our hearts for the rest of our lives. Do you see what he's saying here? That if there's something that is bigger to you than God, like, let's say the approval of my mom and dad, and, like, they think my career is silly, they think that I'm wasting my time by studying the Bible and all this kind of stuff. Let's say that I care so much about their approval, and I would say, you know, I know God's forgiven me, but I still feel like I haven't forgiven myself. What Timothy Keller here is saying is that if you ever say something like that, there's something you're putting above God's approval of you, and whatever that thing is, you don't feel like you've been approved by it yet. In other words, you should feel forgiven because the God of the universe has forgiven you. And your problem is that you haven't oriented yourself enough towards what he's done for you. It's not that you need to muster up some superhuman strength that the Bible never says that we need to have by learning to forgive ourselves, because we cannot do that. We feel forgiven when we know God has forgiven us. And that's what we need to meditate on and think about. Matt?
So, I just asking a question. Self-guilt still plays a part, because that, I mean, I still have a little guilt of some sins in the past.
Oh, for sure.
And find that with Paul.
Right.
And the apostles.
I'm the chief of sinners.
Chief of sinners, least of the apostles.
Yep.
And so it's not as, you don't still feel guilt from the sins of your past.
No.
It's that you've been forgiven of those. And so they're, just like we talked about at the very beginning, they've been wiped clean.
Right.
And that guilt kind of of the sins of the past drives you, is also a driving force.
And in those passages where Paul talks about being the chief of sinners, he'll talk in that same context about how God has forgiven him, though, things like that. But you never see Paul saying, but I need to learn how to forgive myself. So that's why I say, like, I don't like this phrase, but when somebody says something, like, they're in a ballpark that makes sense still. Like, there's something that they're saying that's true to their given experience that I don't want to diminish, but don't use this term. Is it, yeah. Wes, and then there's a couple other hands.
Another term that we've, that is closely paired with guilt that we haven't talked about is shame. And I think that they pair it together. So the opposite of guilt is forgiveness, but the opposite of shame is glory.
Mm.
And so this idea that we see ourselves as forgiven, but we don't see ourselves as leaving the shame of what we've done before. And where I think that I'm seeking to find that is, and see that is that the way that we experience Christ's blessings is that he's raised us up to seat with him in heavenly places, to spiritually and experience his spiritual gifts like Ephesians 1, and to have this glory with him already but not yet.
Yeah.
And that if we can move our, you know, compass to that direction, maybe we can get out of the shame that we're continuing to live.
Right, and the Bible says to, like, press onward. I don't think Paul was constantly loathing what he did in the past. When he happened to think about it, he would say, yeah, I can't believe I did those things. But he wasn't, like, there all the time. There's a lot of things to say about all that. But, McCord, did you have something?
Well, I was just going to say that there's probably a difference between guilt and just remembering your past mistakes and being like, yeah, I was wrong. And that's
yeah.
what I felt like Paul was doing, was just remembering past mistakes instead of actually being like, I don't know, he's still feel worried about being forgiven for stuff like that.
Yeah, Paul, yeah, that's a, whenever Paul says these things, he's not like, you know, I'm not sure that he forgave me. He's like, he has. And that's why I can have boldness and confidence. It's been done away with. But I think him remembering that always helps him appreciate what God had done for him. So, yeah, good. Chase?
I feel like the self-guilt thing is you might have been forgiven from something, but the consequences are lasting.
Yeah, so you feel like an idiot because of, yeah.
I think of, like, when somebody cheats on their wife.
Yeah.
Like, you can be forgiven for that sin, but your wife may leave you.
Yeah.
And it's not just because God's going to forgive you doesn't mean you get your wife back.
Right.
Like, you've made that mistake, and you have to deal with those consequences the rest of your life.
Right.
Just the same way with one.
Right. So there's still going to be a psychological struggle, but you're forgiven.
Right.
But don't ever say that you can forgive yourself or you're struggling to forgive yourself. That's not biblical language. Yeah. So, okay. Any other thoughts on that? All right, let's talk about the biblical solution. We just got a couple minutes, and this is like one of the most highly debated issues over the last 2,000 years, is why does Jesus' death on the cross matter to us? I like this quote, though, and I got this from Ben Edwards. He sent this to me earlier this week. This is from an atheist. He says, I'm not a fan of Christianity. For many years, I have been what some might call a militant atheist, the type who is far more likely to catalog the pitfalls of faith than to highlight the benefits. But more and more, I am enamored of one element of Christianity that I consider its most striking and most laudable feature, forgiveness. So here's an atheist that says, like, there's a lot of things I don't like about Christianity, but there is something good about it. And Nick, did you bring up a quote similar to that earlier?
I brought up something about psychology and forgiveness.
I thought somebody else had
it.
It was Ben. Okay, all right. Well, this is a good quote. I like this one. I like the candid kind of writing that somebody like this has. So the question would be, like, why is forgiveness possible in Christianity, but all these secular approaches to this problem of guilt do not work? Jesus' sacrifice. In Mark 10:45, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, to give his life as a ransom for many. Uses that kind of language there. Isaiah 53 talks about how he's pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Like, there's all kinds of things that didn't belong to Jesus that were being laid on Jesus. And it's the picture kind of the scapegoat on the Day of Atonement. There's only one sacrifice in the Old Testament where people confess the sins over the animal. Like, let's say that when you're making an offering and you put your hand on the animal and it's a burnt offering and it has something to do with the forgiveness of sins, and my sin transfers to the animal, isn't the animal supposed to be unblemished when it's sacrificed? So now it's become blemished? Like, what? So the only animal where people lay their hands on an animal and they confess sins over it is the scapegoat that runs outside the camp. It's like a ritual garbage truck that takes the trash away. That's the picture of forgiveness. This is in John chapter 1, by the way, that Jesus takes the sin of the world away. Like this ritual garbage truck. So you got that picture there. But there's a whole lot of questions like that get into all of this. But you can see that at least however you land on like what Jesus did and how it makes forgiveness possible, you see that there's this